when you consider the lack of flight recording data from some of the crash sites, as well as the absolute, well, what's the word? Lack of,
Lack of words.
yeah, lack of words.
Yeah.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 17 of the Co-Conspirators Podcast. I'm your host, Callum, and joining me are my ever-present co-hosts, Luke
Hi, everyone.
and John.
Hello.
Before we jump into this week's episode, a quick shout out to our listeners on the various podcasting platforms out there. We've reached people in countries all across the world, from Austria to Australia, Brazil to Bulgaria, and Norway to New Zealand, as well as being played in over half of the US states. Having such a global audience is something we never have imagined when we started this. It's always exciting seeing new countries appearing in our analytics, so tell your friends if you enjoy the podcast. Anyway, on with the episode. This week sees us return to one of our most popular topics, and easily one of the most widely recognised and controversial conspiracy theories ever to have been exposed to the public forum. We last discussed this theory at length 9 episodes ago, and at the date of recording, it's been 11 weeks since that episode was released. So even if you somehow managed to miss the title of this podcast, there's no prizes for guessing which conspiracy we plan to dissect today. That's right, it's the events of the 11th of September 2001, known on the streets as 9/11, and to those versed in conspiracy lore as George Bush's Dirty Little Secrets. So given that this is our second episode delving into the fascinating world of 9/11 conspiracies, I'll just do a brief overview of the official narrative. For a more comprehensive retelling, feel free to check out our first 9/11 episode, linked in the description below. So, the US government's version of events is as follows. On the 11th of September 2001, four planes bound for California were hijacked by a group of 19 Al-Qaeda terrorists. Starting at 8:45 a.m., it took just under an hour and a half for these planes to be used in the most devastating terrorist attack ever to have taken place on American soil. Two Boeing 767 airliners targeted the World Trade Center in New York City. American Airlines Flight 11 crashed into the North Tower of the Twin Towers, followed just 18 minutes later by United Airlines Flight 175's impact with the South Tower. 1 hour after the first crash, American Airlines Flight 77 crashed into the west side of the Pentagon military headquarters before United Flight 93 plummeted into a Pennsylvania field. Its target was suspected to be the White House, but passengers attempted to thwart the hijackers after learning about the other three attacks. The heat caused by the burning jet fuel, as well as the initial impacts of the crashes, severely damaged the structural integrity of the Twin Towers, bringing them crashing down. In total, 2,996 people were killed in the 9/11 attacks, including the 19 terrorist hijackers aboard the four airplanes. Citizens of 78 countries died in New York, Washington, D.C., and Pennsylvania. 2,763 died at the World Trade Center, including firefighters, police officers, and paramedics, while 189 people were killed in the Pentagon crash, including 64 on American Airlines Flight 77.
Yeah, one thing I never realized actually is how many British people actually died in the attack. I know that obviously every death is as tragic as the next, but it just surprised me it was that much. I didn't realize the UK itself was as connected to the event as that.
Shows what a global world we live in nowadays. People from all different countries spread across the world. So 19 years have passed since the events of 9/11, giving conspiracy theorists plenty of time to highlight numerous so-called inconsistencies within the official narrative, accusing the US government of a cover-up on the grandest scale. Last time out, we examined three theories that included both the events of the attack, as well as the wider context and potential ulterior motives from the US government. The first was known as pancake theory, which scrutinized the strange mechanics and physics behind the tower's collapse. Secondly, was the apparent absence of military intervention from the government and the conflicting explanations for why none of the hijacked airliners were successfully intercepted. Finally, we revealed evidence of insider trading of airline stocks, potentially implying prior knowledge of the attack, along with potential financial incentive for bringing the towers down. This time out, we have three more theories that have emerged from the mysterious and shadowy world of 9/11 conspiracies. Some of the ideas presented today build on what we have discussed previously, while others may offer a fresh perspective on such a monumental day in US history. So I hope you're not growing tired of my voice because I'm about to kick things off with the first theory.
Never grow tired of those tones.
Glad someone doesn't.
Do you guys know the official length of time before something technically becomes history?
I haven't got a clue, no.
No, I don't.
It's supposed to be 20 years. So essentially, this is the last year we can talk about it before it becomes kind of history. like actual history.
You think just yesterday it was 2010 when it's really, it was 10 years ago. Stuff like that does surprise me quite a lot. Things like the World Cup for
LMFAO, Party Rock, or whatever. That came out like
Party Rock
ago.
Anthem. Yeah. I've listened to it every day since.
In 10 years' time, that'll become history and they'll be playing Kiss FM.
When LMFAO starts getting onto on Heart Radio, that's when you know you've got a problem. Luckily, I had 10 years since of more AIDS pop songs, so nothing really changing there. Shout out Cardi B for her latest effort.
Oh, no.
Work clearly has gone mad. But anyway, back to a more recent topic. Although, as Luke did state, it will be history in just a year from now, so enjoy it while it's still contemporary, I say. Even though when it gets written into the history books, there'll still be plenty of discussion around it, that's for sure. So my theory takes a closer look at the 19 hijackers that are believed to have perpetrated the deadly attacks, specifically in the cases of American Airlines Flight 11, United Airlines Flight 175, and American Airlines Flight 77. The likelihood that they would have been capable to perform the complex feats of piloting required to hit their targets. The hijackers were organized into four teams, each led by a pilot-trained hijacker with three or four acting as muscle to help subdue the pilots, passengers and crew. The four pilots were Mohammed Atta, who crashed Flight 11 into the North Tower, Marwan al-Shehi, who steered Flight 175 into the South Tower, Hani Hanjour, responsible for hitting the Pentagon with Flight 77, and Ziad Jarrah, who was at the controls of Flight 93.
Do you know if they were armed when they were on the planes? Because three people as muscle doesn't seem like very many to restrain like an entire plane.
Well, the official story states that they were armed with box cutters, I think, and maybe penknife type things. And I think I saw also a mention of mace being amongst their arsenal of weaponry.
Okay.
Once you're in the cockpit, isn't that kind of it, though? Isn't it like nearly break down the cockpit door?
Well, it is now, but I know a lot of aviation rules and designs changed kind of as a result of 9/11. So I think it was certainly easier back then, but you would still assume there was some sort of lock on the cockpit. But then again, how did they get in there in the first place?
I suppose there's a few, I would say, rumours. I mean, recounts of a couple of passengers were stabbed, but it's very hard to confirm given what happened to the planes. And part of that I will touch on as we get later into this theory, but there's quite a lot to get through. Two other prospective pilots, Khalid al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hamzi, who are both relegated to the role of muscle, failing to obtain their pilot's license after being kicked out of a San Diego flight school for incompetence.
I'm just trying not to laugh when you say the names. You're actually doing a good job of pronouncing them.
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
Yeah.
The most British pronunciation of Arabic names. In an interview with Rick Garza, the flight instructor responsible for their expulsion, he described the pair as dumb and dumber, saying that they failed to grasp simple radio communications and lacked the mechanical aptitude for basic flight operations. Garza alleged that the two wanted to skip the typical training plane, a single-engine Cessna 172, and get straight to flying Boeing jets. So if that doesn't really raise a few red flags, I'm not sure what would, especially if they were as incompetent as they seemed.
So I wanted to learn to drive a car, and like, no, I'll go straight to an F1 car, thanks.
Why not? As Max Verstappen won the Grand Prix without even passing his test, so.
I was talking about that with my brother the other day, and I was thinking, do you reckon he had driving lessons for the normal car, or do you reckon he just got in?
Surely he just got in and passed.
Because you have to learn to pass the like, technicalities of the test rather than just drive. But it would have been weird thinking of him having driving lessons.
Well, hitting the apex of every cul-de-sac, absolutely redlining it. Given that the two, muscle hijackers who didn't make the grade for being pilots were not actually revealed to be the pilots of any of the four hijacked planes, you might think that any conspiracies questioning the supposed piloting skill of the hijackers are falsely extrapolating the cases of al-Midar and al-Hamzi, assuming that the other pilots were equally inept. It's well established that all four pilots undertook a degree of flight training on American soil. The two terrorists responsible for the World Trade Center attack, Mohammed Atta and Marwan al-Shehi, trained together at Huffman Aviation, Venice, Florida. According to the owner of the school, Rudy Deckers, Atta arrived with a private pilot certificate while al-Shehi started as a complete beginner, describing them as average in their exams and flying.
Imagine the reputational damage that flying school's taken. Mm-hmm. You trained the hijackers of 9/11.
I'm surprised
they've come back from it.
Yeah. I mean,
I think that's one of the biggest flight schools in America, where loads of pilots from across the world go to train.
You've got them on the Wall of Fame.
It can't be easy to get a huge jumbo jet, like, crashing into quite a realistically small target. I mean, a big target, but in the grand scheme of things, a small target. So clearly did a good job.
Yeah.
Just on the subject of reputation, say, Rick Garza, there's a long article about detailing how he struggled to find work after being revealed to have had two of the 9/11 hijackers at his flight school, even though he failed them and told them, "No, you're not good enough. I don't trust you."
I mean, you can't put any blame at his door. I mean, there's no way you could have ever known.
Yeah, because you think when you're running a flight school, it's your incentive to keep people there, to keep them paying for training. So it's actually to go around and tell them, right, you're not good enough, you're not going to be cut out for pilots. And then a few months down the line, you just see the news and see their names and then get a knock on the door from the FBI, which is what happens. You think, you know, your whole world's come crumbling down around you.
Exactly. Maybe they only did the 9/11 to prove a point against him.
Well, these two didn't even make the greatest pilots. They were relegated just to be the henchmen.
Oh, right. So he did win in the end then.
A small victory in the grand scheme of things. So after attending the flight school in Florida, Al-Shehhi and Atta also enrolled in a six-hour simulation course where they practiced flying various Boeing airliners. The simulation training is used to solidify the argument that the hijackers were definitely responsible for piloting the plane. According to diehard debunkers, those are people who are absolutely towing the official narrative and determined to disparage any conspiracy theorists, crashing the planes into the Twin Towers and Pentagon would have been as simple as engaging autopilot to the required destination and then crashing the plane. It's just doing a little bit of steering. So in the case of the Twin Towers hijackers, all they'd have to do was to plug in JFK Airport, wait until they'd reach the airport, pick out the Twin Towers, retake the controls and steer them, and then crash. However, air traffic controllers monitoring the flights told a different story, especially for the case of United Airlines Flight 175, piloted by the less experienced Al-Shehhi. According to controller Dave, it's an American I'm going to butcher, Dave Battaglia, that's maybe slightly Italian, but you know. Flight 175 made a hard left turn before climbing 3,000 feet in the space of a minute, a very rapid ascension, unlike anything the controllers had seen before. The plane then entered a very fast descent at a rate of 10,000 feet per minute, unheard of for a 100-ton commercial airliner, which was seeing the aircraft reach an almost vertical trajectory. In the tower, Dave recalled the altitude countdown of 6,000 feet, 4,000 feet, 2,000 feet before Al-Shehhi, who is alleged to have never flown a jet in person, leveled the airliner, identified the South Tower, performed a tight banking maneuver, and crashed into the building. There's also footage of this second crash. It's quite a spectacular maneuver. Plane almost comes in sideways.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, I'd imagine it's incredibly difficult. I didn't realize flying a plane, well, I don't want to simplify it, but it's as easy as just typing in the airport destination and just going to sleep or whatever.
Yeah, it is. Once you're up cruising, you can literally just sit there and do nothing. It's just a landing and the takeoff, so I think you need input for.
Even then, we were speaking to our air traffic controller friend, who says that the landing is sort of handled by computers now, and the pilots are just there in case they have to like manually intervene.
Got to press the seatbelt sign though, haven't they? That's important.
Yeah. This is your captain speaking. That's a bit you dread it going to announce your voice. Also, the case of Ziad Jarrah followed a similar pattern, and he was the alleged pilot behind United Airlines Flight 93. This one didn't reach its intended target, instead crashing into the Pennsylvanian countryside. The official 9/11 commission reported, just 2 months before the terror attacks, he attempted to fly the Hudson Corridor using a small private plane, which is a popular tourist route offering a bird's eye view of New York. However, Hortman Flight School deemed him unfit to fly solo, stating that he'd have to take an instructor out with him should he wish to do the flight. 2 months later, Cleveland air traffic controls would observe the extreme maneuvers allegedly performed by Jarrah at the controls of Flight 93. This consisted of a sharp U-turn followed by a rapid descent so fast, I quote, that the computers couldn't keep up with it. The target of the hijacking was never reached after a passenger insurrection, which does suggest that the rapid descent may have been the result of passenger intervention. And furthermore, such observations were made by controllers in Cleveland, Ohio, over 500 miles from Washington, D.C. So it makes very little sense for the hijackers to begin descending to attack altitude so far away from the capital.
It doesn't really make any sense, does it, that you just cruise so low? Unless you wanted to just... It would be a scene, wouldn't it, if you were just flying that low constantly before hitting a target. But yeah, I think more likely is probably that it was passengers taking control of it.
This next one, though, it's a lot more, I'll say cut and dry, because it's a conspiracy theory. It's never going to be cut and dry, but there seems to be a lot more compelling evidence behind the overall aim of the theory I'm trying to detail, which is the case of Hani Hanjour, the pilot or alleged pilot of United Flight 77. He has been described as a pretty weak student by Duncan Hasty, the president of the CRM Airline Training Center in Scottsdale, Arizona, where Hani enrolled as a complete beginner. According to Hasty, Hanjour never progressed beyond the solo engine level and was, quote, someone not cut out to be a pilot with no understanding of the principles of aviation. yet he had also inquired about piloting Boeing 757s. From an aerial perspective, the Pentagon offers roughly 30 acres of visible building, and it's also worth noting that it stands at just 22 meters tall. With this considered, one would assume that the simplest way to hit the building and inflict maximum damage would be to guide the plane down onto the roof, surely achievable even to an amateur pilot.
I reckon their initial plan was just to like kind of pass the American pilot's test and just literally become pilot of a normal passenger plane and then just sort it out that way.
I think that'd be a bit more long-winded to rely on them all being hired by the same airline companies.
Got a grind.
Getting assigned these same flights all at similar times to basically have their simultaneous attacks.
Imagine 9/11 never happened because you failed the interview.
I think that the piloting was probably commanded by their terrorist cell organisers, if you're to believe that it was perpetrated by these individuals, just to make sure they were capable of taking the planes to the correct destinations and making sure that maximum terror was inflicted. So, back to Hani. Having reached Washington with the Pentagon in sight, Hanjour apparently elected to disconnect the autopilot and manually perform a high-speed descending manoeuvre, banking 330 degrees, almost a full circle. This would have created a much more complicated approach, causing him to lose sight of the Pentagon temporarily, with the additional task of having to negotiate treetops and light poles. Visibility would have also been reduced from a 30-acre Pentagon as observed from above to a 22-metre-tall rectangle. All of this to crash into the side of the building while flying at 500 miles per hour. I've also seen a recreation of the flight path for this one. It is another very impressive manoeuvre for such a rank amateur. In fact, numerous pilots have highlighted the incredible skill required to keep an 100-ton airliner level at such low altitude. Travelling at such high speeds would render the surrounding environment as a blur, while also massively increasing the responsiveness of the jet plane's control stick, with any slight movement likely to elicit a massive response from the jet. Simulations have attempted to replicate Hanjour's flight trajectory, with differing results, but when the correct altitude and speed of approach, believed to be 500 miles an hour, there were very, very few successful outcomes, even for skilled pilots, with many basically recounting it's a nigh on impossible manoeuvre. You'd have to be Chuck Yeager, famous American pilot, to be able to pull off such a feat, let alone in a 100-ton 757 airliner. In fact, air traffic controllers in Washington, D.C. thought the manoeuvre was that of a military fighter jet, given the speed and precision, claiming that flying a 757 in that manner would have been unsafe. While clearly safety was towards the bottom of Hanjour's priority list, several highly experienced military flight experts have publicly expressed their doubts at the ability of a relative amateur to perform such a feat. So this is where things also get a little bit more interesting with regards to the Pentagon itself. So Flight 77 struck with the western wing of the Pentagon, hitting the outermost of the five rings, implying, in this case, that the attacks were orchestrated by the US government. The attack trajectory that would have likely inflicted maximum damage, i.e. hitting the roof from above, would have placed thousands of lives at risk, including those of high-ranking officials. In order to justify that the country was under attack, all that needed to happen was for the Pentagon to be hit, potentially limiting the number of casualties. Given that the airliner struck the west wing from the side, the opposite side, to the location of the Pentagon's critical command centres from which the Secretary of Defence and other key figures operate, there is certainly an argument to be made here. Further fueling such a conspiracy is the revelation that the area of the Pentagon struck in the attack had just been renovated. The purpose of such renovations, any guesses?
Prevent.
No idea.
I don't know.
Make it plane-proof, were you about to say.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. The official thing explanation is to render the building able to withstand a terrorist attack.
Oh my god.
Ceiling steel beams and reinforced blast walls were added to all five floors.
I can just picture a Boeing going into the Pentagon like a pigeon flying into a window.
There was also Kevlar mesh, which maintained the structural integrity to minimise shrapnel following the impact. As renovations had just finished, the area was still vacated, potentially to minimise the loss of life. It's been alleged that the rumour of a strike on the outside wall has been circulating around the top brass at the Pentagon, perhaps further substantiating the military foreknowledge theory I discussed in our previous 9/11 episode. Here's a name I'm definitely going to butcher. Jim Mikluszewski, by Polish origin. Close enough. Yeah, so Jim, the NBC correspondent at the Pentagon on the day of the attacks, was obviously at the Pentagon for 9/11. He recalls encountering a military intelligence official around the time that the second tower had been hit, who stated that it was, quote, clearly an act of terrorism. He was then claimed to have leant in and whispered to Jim that this attack was clearly so well coordinated, so if I were you, I would stay away from the E-ring for the rest of the day because we're next.
He was at the Pentagon when it was hit, or he was going to be, and then
he was at the Pentagon when it was hit. So in the midst of the 9/11 terror attacks, he got this news after the second tower was hit at around just past 9 o'clock in the morning,
saying, "Stay away from this area of the Pentagon."
Basically, stay away from the outside most perimeter, because the Pentagon's made up of 5 sections, I think, which they got A to E from inside to outside.
God, yeah, it's dodgy.
Yeah. So on the subject of foreknowledge, Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense at the time, had been accused of predicting the imminent Pentagon attack. This came from an interview with Christopher Cox, who was the serving Defense Policy Committee chairman of the House of Representatives, who claims that Rumsfeld was watching the TV coverage from New York and said, quote, "Believe me, this isn't over yet. There's going to be another attack, and it could be us."
Why would you say that? If you did have knowledge, why would you say to me like that?
I don't know. It's the heat of the moment. Maybe you just lose your head. You realize this is actually real, very real, and will be happening soon.
Mm.
Even though you're safely on the side of the Pentagon where it's not going to be hit, and you assume the blast balls do their job and the plane doesn't hit from this very improbable angle and shear all the way through the building, you should be relatively safe. But still, you never know what you're going to do until it happens. But back to the hijackers. The only CCTV footage that shows any of them in airports on the day of the attack was taken from an airport in Portland, Maine. It showed Abdulaziz Al-Hamari and Mohammed Atta, one of the pilots, passing through a security check at the Portland airport before they are believed to have boarded a connecting flight to Boston in the early hours of the morning. From that Boston airport, American Airlines Flight 11 was due to take off, and that would be the one that they would hijack. Of course, this could still implicate them, but it doesn't explain the whereabouts of the other 17 terrorists, even if perfectly preserved passports were found amongst World Trade Center debris and Flight 93 wreckage. The only footage to show any of the terrorists in the 3 airports from which they boarded their target planes was released in 2005, depicting the group led by our friend Hani Hanjour passing through security at Washington Dulles. However, there was no time recording on this footage, which certainly defies the norm for any release of security footage, and appeared to run much more smoothly than the time-lapse-like security recordings that would have been expected from 2001. This certainly questions the legitimacy of the footage, as the hackers were believed to have taken a number of dry run flights following the same route as they supposedly planned to take on 9/11, and this is all from the 9/11 Commission. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that this footage could have been taken from a practice run and repurposed to fit the narrative, but still does not explain the higher video quality. To account for the lack of footage from the 3 airports on the day of the attack, the 9/11 Commission wrote, "The security checkpoint in Newark, one of the airports, like the checkpoints in Boston, lacked closed-circuit television, which is in contradiction to claims from the FBI that claim to have examined footage from dozens of cameras at the 3 airports where terrorists boarded their flights." But even to this date, there's been very limited, practically no footage except for those 2005 recordings that show any of the terrorists in any locations in the airports, despite multiple cameras likely to have been posted through all the different areas, from the departure lounge to security gates, check-in, waiting in line, etc., etc. And one further twist, out of the 8 flight recorders that could have been salvaged from the 4 airliners, with each vehicle being equipped with a cockpit voice recorder and a flight data recorder, only 3 were found in working condition. The black boxes, which are painted orange for visibility, withstand heat of over 1,000 degrees centigrade and are clearly designed to withstand the impact of a crash in order to preserve vital data. Despite months spent meticulously searching the rubble from the World Trade Center, none of the 4 recorders were ever found from flights 11 and 175. At the Pentagon crash site, the cockpit recorder was found, but the footage was deemed irretrievable, while the cockpit recorder from flight 93 was also found, but these contents have never been released by the FBI, despite requests from the families of those on board. Flight data recorders found at the 2 sites from which the flight trajectories I referenced earlier were mapped, so that being Flight 93 and Flight 77, have never had their serial numbers revealed to the public, so cannot officially be verified as belonging to Flights 77 and 93. So essentially what that means, well, in the case of an airline accident and the black box has been found, its serial number is printed on the accident report so it can be corroborated that having belonged to that plane. So given that these serial numbers weren't printed in the 9/11 Commission, theorists have taken this to believe that it could have either been completely different flight recorders or different planes that were used. One final point regarding these flight recorders. The only voice clips that exist of the hijackings were taken from American Airlines Flight 11, where pilot Mohammed Atta was alleged to have accidentally contacted air traffic control on the ground instead of relaying his message to the passengers. Also, this same mistake was made by Zaid Jarrah, supposedly at the controls of United Flight 93, who also radioed air traffic control accidentally. Conspiracists allege that these recordings could have been transmitted from any flight or location, so it's only the word of the US government that links them to the corresponding flights. So that's where I'll throw it over to you guys. Obviously, there's quite a lot to unpack here, from questions about the hijacker's piloting skill, evidence placing the terrorists on the hijacked plane in terms of CCTV and flight data recorders, as well as the further details on potential foreknowledge with regards to the Pentagon attack. So for believability, if you get to judge it, I'm just asking you to rate it in terms of how plausible you find the idea that several so-called novice pilots were able to hijack four airliners and perform complex flying maneuvers in order to override flight computers and autopilot systems, ultimately hitting their targets with military-like precision.
I think it's certainly interesting, and something that kind of comes to my mind when we're talking about this is the episode we did a couple of weeks ago regarding the times that conspiracy theories were proven true. And there's a lot of stuff that kind of runs in parallel with the Iran flight that was shot down, you know, the FBI keeping the black box, there not being recordings, the government not releasing like the serial numbers, stuff like that. And if that never came out, we'd kind of be debating whether that was true. And it seems like the same again here.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't go any way towards increasing public trust in the light of such a catastrophic event.
Places I get they like can it can mess with an investigation, but then when it's nearly 19 years old now, you think that's kind of unneeded, and especially when they've got their own official story.
And they've also, if you believe the conspiracy theories, they've got what they wanted out of the Iraq war, which was really all the oil and Bin Laden.
Yeah, I think overall as a conspiracy, is this very, very action-packed. There's lots of nitty-gritty details. There's lots of evidence backing it up as well, which not only makes it an interesting theory, but a believable theory and a very credible one. So as it's also regarding 9/11, which, you know, is the biggest event there is, I'm going to score it highly, of course, and I'm going to give it a 9 out of 10. So in terms of scoring believability, as those were the pilots, and they were on the plane and they performed those ridiculous tricks, it's going to score quite low for me, realistically. I think, you know, you mentioned the maneuvers, there's no way that they could perform anything like that. And when you've got people kind of coming out and saying, you know, all they had to do was go on autopilot to JFK and then just turn around and do that, but then that completely contradicts what actually happened, that also raises big suspicions. Yeah, as I mentioned, it's going to score low. I'm going to go for a 3 out of 10 that those amateur pilots that failed all the pilot tests in the US could possibly do what they did on that day.
Yeah, it's good. So it almost flips the believability on its head there.
It's, like, it's confusing me so much.
Yeah, I did realise at the time, and yeah, we have essentially decided we're doing the believability now for the official narrative rather than the actual conspiracy, but I think let's run with it.
A weird concept. Yeah, I 100% believe that, so I'm going to give believability 1 out of 10. Yeah, I'll give my thoughts. So, yeah, in terms of an overall conspiracy, I think as much as maybe it's a somewhat overlooked aspect of 9/11, you know, looking at the hijackers themselves, I actually do think more and more now it's something that people are focusing on, and certainly hadn't heard anywhere near those details before, but I was aware, you know, that they were thought of as incompetent, and a few people have raised questions on that. So it's a really interesting part of what is the biggest conspiracy theory of all time. So, yeah, overall score is a 9 out of 10 from me as well. In terms of the believability part, again, I think it is pretty believable, you know. The manoeuvres, particularly the Pentagon one, it's very convenient because, like you said, it doesn't make sense why you wouldn't attack it from the top, which would, in essence, make it a target you couldn't miss and do a lot more damage. And then, you know, the way that it had to bank quite abruptly and go very, very low in order to hit what it was, 22 metres high, did you say? I mean,
yeah.
That's going to be very difficult to hit for even the most experienced pilots, so let alone novices and people who have been chucked out of flight school and things like that. I know there is a bit of contention that we'll probably save for another time around whether a plane actually hit the Pentagon at all, because there's no footage of it at all and there was very little debris found. And kind of the hole in the Pentagon was something stupid like 5 meters wide. And you think that doesn't really figure, it would have to hit it completely side on to go through that, which would have made it even more unnecessarily difficult as a maneuver and also limit damage. So I think that's another side of people perhaps don't believe that a plane even hit it at all, which I suppose would add weight to your claim because it's basically backing up the fact that it was a really difficult maneuver to do and the supposed pilots couldn't have ever done it. Again, you touched on the second tower that got hit, again, a huge bank, and then he almost looks like he's going to miss the tower and has to do a last minute spin to hit it almost.
Yeah, the footage for that does almost look CGI though, just the way it hits the tower. That's why when I first saw it, I thought, okay, there's no way that can be real, but if that's what they claim as the official footage.
Yeah, it is a pretty crazy video. All eyes were on the second one, weren't they? Because the first one was being filmed. But so there are plenty of angles on it.
It does not look like a real plane.
No, it's been described as a butter plane because it goes straight through.
On its completely on its side as well. You think that's quite difficult for such a big vehicle, but you know.
Well, yeah, especially for an inexperienced pilot. So yeah, on this new inverted believability scale, I think we'll actually agree with Luke again and go for a 3 out of 10.
Very nice. Yeah, just to wrap things up. So sorry about accidentally getting that wrong with the believability, mixing things up a bit. But yeah, as the theory goes, I was a little bit apprehensive about looking into the hijackers just because I thought there wouldn't really be that much information on them because the FBI want to keep it covered up. But some conspiracists have clearly done a lot of digging regards to their flight backgrounds. There's now numerous articles from flight schools that have trained them, etc., which doesn't really paint them in a brilliant light. I think Mohammed Atta, out of the four, he had a pilot's license before he actually came to America. And that's why there's not really much to be said about the guy who hit the North Tower. But the Pentagon one especially, I think that raises the most red flags. Yes, it's a really important target from a terrorist perspective, but from a US government perspective, if they were to orchestrate it, they would really want to minimize the damage, whereas a terrorist would want to inflict maximum damage. So it just does not explain why a terrorist would want to fly into a much harder 22-meter tall wall rather than a 30-acre, nice big Pentagon-shaped area where they just have to point their nose down and say their prayers, as opposed to doing almost a full circle, almost on your side, pull the nose up at 500 miles an hour, while also crashing through lampposts and trees on their final approach. And then what John mentioned, which I didn't even consider, was the fact that the actual hole in the Pentagon doesn't seem to match up with the indentation of what you think a jet would make, even though it's probably disintegrated thanks to the convenient installation of extra Kevlar and blast doors. It's almost like there are too many conveniences for this not to have been orchestrated. But how they've done it, that's another question. Another, of course, interesting angle is just the fact that the hijackers may not even have been on the planes at all, when you consider the lack of flight recording data from some of the crash sites, as well as the lack of a CCTV footage from any of the three airports, despite you think even before the massive security overhaul that was given to airports post 9/11, there would have been some CCTV, surely, especially if the FBI claimed to have combed through hours of footage. None of this has been released, so you can't really place them. Where, for that reason, I'm going to give this one a solid, I think, 9.5 out of 10. I think it's fascinating the more you dig into it. And it's just surprising to see how people vehemently support the official narrative and claiming it flying planes is like driving trucks. I think one of the debunkers has been quoted this day as an amateur wanted to get it horizontal to the ground and just steer left and right. That's why they flew really, really low into the Pentagon, which doesn't make sense given how many highly experienced pilots have rubbished these claims and said it's an almost impossible maneuver for an amateur, let alone in an 100-ton massive airline that none of them had really flown before. And so for our inverted believability, I'm going to, let's say, be boring and follow the rest of the crowd, but just given the information that I presented, research, it's quite hard not to say it's very low to actually believe the official narrative that these were the hijackers on board these planes and they performed these maneuvers. So I'm going to go for a 2 out of 10 on believability. But yeah, that's enough of me. I think I've basically talked myself out. I'll pass it over to someone else to entertain you with their dulcet tones. Luke, you're up.
Okay, thanks, Callum, for that very detailed, evidence-heavy conspiracy. Mine's not quite going to be the same. It's a bit of a, you know, more out there theory, but it's interesting nonetheless.
So, like, balance on this podcast.
It is. Well, it's a nice balance for sure. So you've definitely heard the story of Al-Qaeda doing 9/11. You've almost certainly heard the story of Bush doing 9/11. You've probably heard the story of Mossad doing 9/11. Now it's time for the less successful sequel. That is, the Swiss did 9/11. Now, for regular listeners of the podcast, you might remember that I presented a theory during our World War II episode, and that was that the Swiss were secretly funding and running the whole Nazi regime from behind their mountains, despite claiming neutrality. I'd just like to say I have no personal vendetta against Switzerland. This is all just a bit of fun, and I found it quite interesting and funny to research this theory, so don't kill me, Swiss Mafia.
Are you going on a bit of a one-man crusade against Switzerland?
Someone's got to speak up, man.
Via the medium of a very niche internet podcast.
Has our podcast reached Switzerland?
It hasn't, interestingly.
Oh, there you go then. Sodom.
Okay, so before I start, let's jump into a little bit of history. So 9/11 is a big day, not only in American history and memory, but also in Nazi history. Granted, the dates are switched due to the American date system, and the Nazis actually having the 9th of November as their national holiday, but it was commonly referred to as 9/11, just like in the States. In fact, in Hitler's infamous book, Mein Kampf, the last page ends with, "We must always remember 9/11 and the heroes that died that day."
God, that's creepy, that.
So I don't know if either of you know the relevance of 9/11 within a Nazi party and Adolf Hitler himself.
No, enlighten me.
No, I don't either.
Sure, so it's actually seen as the birth of Hitler's Nazi party. So on the day in 1930, the 9th of November, Hitler declared himself leader and then he led his party on a march through Munich. The march was stopped by Bavarian police who opened fire and 16 Nazis died and 4 policemen also died. Thereafter, the 9th of November was a national holiday in Germany in memory of the Nazis who died. Not only that, it was commonly referred to by Hitler as an important day for the Nazis, and as I mentioned, it was on the last page of Mein Kampf. He also chose the day in 1938, just the year before the start of the World War, to burn synagogues and Jewish property on a large scale, killing 400 Jews in the process. So, as you can imagine, for European Jews, 9/11 was a day widely hated, especially as it was a day the Nazis heavily celebrated. Now, I won't touch too much on what I mentioned in the previous podcast episode, so if you want to hear more about that, go check out the World War II episode. But during the last days of World War II, the Nazis quickly moved a lot of assets, aptly named Nazi gold, to Switzerland, a lot of which were assets and money stolen from Jewish businesses, families, and properties. Despite, of course, claiming neutrality, Switzerland were happy to put financial gain above morals and take the assets. However, fast forwarding a bit into the future, into the 90s and early 2000s, the International Association of Jews sued Switzerland for the return of their gold. Their lawsuit was not actually issued from Switzerland, but from America. Now, their lawsuit and their documentation was issued from the Twin Towers, the World Trade Center, and also another bank in California. Now, this is where things start to get a bit coincidental. If you go back to the initial plans, the supposed initial plans of Osama bin Laden to bomb America, targets he selected matched up with the locations from which the Jews initiated their lawsuit for the return of Nazi gold. To be more precise, the initial plans for the plane bombs included the World Trade Center, but it also included this California bank.
I think I was beginning to start to put the steps in place there. I didn't expect it to be this deep, though.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting. It was in a way, the World Trade Center was a center for this lawsuit. A lot of documentation was there, and if this documentation were to disappear or go missing, it would definitely harm their lawsuit. It's worth mentioning, kind of touched on this in the previous podcast, but Switzerland were quite keen not to give back any of the stolen Nazi gold, even though they had kind of recognized they'd taken it.
So they've
Yeah, they
built the banking systems on it, probably as a bit of their reserve.
yeah, no, for sure. I mean, it must have helped them massively. So then what actually happened post 9/11? So first of all, two Swiss nationals died in 9/11. This might seem a reasonable amount for a small nation, but for a bit of context, Poland had 5 deaths and the UK had 67. Now, what's also kind of a bit more out there is the Swiss are generally considered to be kings of the financial world. And so it's quite common for Swiss nationals to be in the World Trade Center. Even more so when you consider the fact that the company Credit Suisse, which is a Swiss banking company, themselves operated within the towers. So you could quite easily expect there to be a lot more than two Swiss nationals within the tower. So, of course, there is a common rumor that no Jews died in the attacks, or many took the day off work. However, according to the official list of those that died, 350 were Jewish, which is well over 10% of the total. And again, for context, 2% of America is Jewish. So, as well, Swiss declared the Nazi gold permanently theirs, claiming that too many Jews died in the Holocaust to justify giving it back to them, and also any documentation was lost in the 9/11 attacks, hitting the lawsuit quite hard and, just setting them back to step one. They've lost all their documentation, years of files and suits they've put together against the Swiss.
That is quite savage, actually. That's so too many of you died during the Holocaust for you to claim back the money that is basically rightfully
Yeah.
yours. That is showing absolutely
It's
no empathy whatsoever.
typical, like, ruthless financial industry, really. In reality, yeah, it's not ours, it belongs to you, but like so much of the money that we have is belonging to people who sadly and tragically killed during World War II.
As you don't have the legal documentation, no matter your moral claim to it, it means nothing in the court.
And now I'm going to ask John this question as a resident economist. So,
Oh
John,
no.
what is the best thing to invest in if the economy crashes?
Don't know, property.
Oh, you've let me down here. So
Planes.
the safest kind, one of the safest investments you can have in an economic crisis is gold.
Oh, I see, yeah.
And now the economy did crash after 9/11, and gold prices resultantly spiked after 9/11. What's interesting is the Swiss own more gold per capita than any other nation on earth by a factor of nearly 30 times. So not only do they own more gold than everyone else, it's 30 times more. The Swiss significantly benefited from the chaos and disorder of the foreign nations after the attack, and their economy profited quite favorably. So as a result of 9/11, not only did they, get to keep this Nazi gold, the lawsuit against them was shut down, and they also economy booming because of gold prices.
Is there any documented communication or collaboration between the Swiss and Osama bin Laden? Has any of that been uncovered?
There isn't, no.
Highly doubt it.
Whereas
No.
actually, it could come out in the future. I mean, the world eventually turns their eyes to Switzerland as being these evil overlords,
Give
despite
it
living
5 years, I say.
in. Yeah. Once your research comes to light, the general public.
Just you wait. So, obviously, after 9/11, what also happened is the Muslim world took the blame, largely due to Osama bin Laden taking credit and it also being the official narrative, as Callum has mentioned. However, within the Arab world itself, rumors spread. At a meeting in Damascus, Syria, in September 2001, with a delegation from the British Royal College of Defence Studies, Syrian Defence Minister Mustafa Tlass said the Mossad planned the ramming of two hijacked airliners into the World Trade Center's towers as part of a Jewish conspiracy. He also told the British visitors that the Mossad had given thousands of Jewish employees of the World Trade Center advance warning not to go to work that day. This was an unsubstantiated claim, but yet one that a high government official was claiming. I think this is a pretty well-known conspiracy, and there are people out there who do, blame Mossad for 9/11.
I've definitely seen that one before.
You would be a bit creeped out, wouldn't you, if you rocked up to work and like thousands of people were missing and
Oh,
no
for
one knew
sure.
why. And then you may or may not put two and two together that all the Jews are missing.
It's not like a bar mitzvah to
If that ever happens to me, I'm getting out of that building
to.
straight away.
Keep tabs on the religions of all your co-workers.
This might just be a conspiracy here. It's one of the more well-known ones, but not massively known. But it's a conspiracy that a high government official was claiming within the Arab world, and he wasn't the only one in the Arab world. A lot of people were pointing their finger at Mossad and Israel. So, I mean, this greatly increased tension between the Jewish and Arab world, which of course had massive fallout for Israel and kind of made the whole situation worse there.
And I mean, they've never been best of friends, have they?
They're always going to be pointing fingers at each other no matter what, I think.
If you think about the overall narrative and assuming that the US government were the perpetrators, if you believe the conspiracy theories, this is perfect for them. It's basically just deflection without having to do anything to sort of letting the conspiracies spread like wildfire and.
Yeah, I mean, it's great, but they are one of the main conspiracies. So there is
I
that
think I'd
too.
be happy for any press that deflects the blame away from them.
But yeah, I mean, it sounds like within the kind of high government world, like the only conspiracies going around were kind of pointing finger at Mossad, unless of course you are Malaysia, in which case you are pointing fingers at Bush and Blair by the sounds of
This is where we find out the Malaysian government's actually just run by diehard conspiracy theorists.
it. So would Switzerland really be despiteful in their drive to keep the Nazi money and also gain from world gold prices? Well, Switzerland does have a long anti-Semitic history. And actually, the first kind of recognized genocide against Jews was the Basel massacre, where they burnt 100 Jews alive, although this was way back, like nearly 1,000 years ago. So times can change.
One from the archives, that's for sure.
That's the oldest conspiracy we've had on this podcast, maybe.
You're a big fan of the history of conspiracies.
Oh, they're just more interesting because there's just so little known about them that, the official story is always up for debate because you're basing it on the word of like some guy who wrote it down on a parchment.
See the Elizabeth the First conspiracy for details.
Yeah.
That is a personal favourite of mine.
It's also quite believable as well when you consider the fact. But yeah, watch
I
the
know.
least Royal Family Conspiracies episode for that one.
Yeah.
So yeah, not only this, Switzerland is actually referenced many times in Jewish literature as being the most anti-Semitic country in the world. I'd imagine that literature was written before
Yes.
1945, but
Imagine having that in Germany exists.
but yeah, additionally, as mentioned, they did take huge financial gain from the Nazis, and as previously mentioned, some even believe financed them. So would they really go as far as choosing 9/11 as a day to attack? To destroy the documentation that was formed against them, to retake the Nazi gold and ingrain the day 9/11 into the American history and world history. So, to recap, there was definitely motive. Destroy the documents for the lawsuit against the Swiss and their Nazi gold, gain from the world gold prices spiking, stir up hatred in the Arab world, causing more problems for Israel. So, what do you guys think?
I say it's got all the elements of a brilliant conspiracy theory. Is this one that you've came up with yourself, or is it something you've found?
Bits and pieces. I found the start of it and then, found more stuff out myself.
You've done a cracking job there. I'm not going to lie. That was surprisingly detailed, given you teased the believability earlier, being not very believable at all. It's got some things that gets you thinking, that's for sure, given the historical context.
Definitely does. I mean, I'm sure many documentation was lost, not just this lawsuit against the Swiss. I'm sure there's all kinds of people who probably benefited in some way from what happened.
Yeah, then the owner, Mr. Silverstein, insured the building against a terrorist attack just days before and then got a $1 billion payout following the
Jeez.
9/11. Not sure how true those claims are. That's definitely a conspiracy theory I've seen,
Yeah, I've heard that many times.
implicating the Jewish as the perpetrators of the attacks. So.
Where did that conspiracy start? Was it Switzerland by any chance?
Yeah, right on the back of a pack of Swiss cheese. Yeah, I'm just
Problem with Swiss conspiracy theories, they're always full of holes.
I still want to know. I still find it funny. Slightly off topic, given just the wider context of your, I'm not going to say beef with Switzerland, but presenting two detailed conspiracy theories against them, I'm just waiting at some weird timeline that conspires for you to be running for the job of British ambassador to Switzerland and then to dig up this podcast and be
Imagine.
able to do it. Don't go into politics, keeping them all
I
this be dragged out.
did mention last episode I was working for a Swiss company which has swiftly been taken over since the episode, so proudly I no longer work.
Were you there when they were signing on the dotted line?
Damn right, I was forcing the finger.
Gun to a head.
But yeah, I really enjoyed this one. It was something completely unexpected when you think about the typical path for 9/11 conspiracies, like I've trodden just discussing, oh, the hijackers, the Pentagon, etc. And I was going to pull the rug from out of you over to Switzerland now, and then also detailing long-running tensions between the Arabs and Jewish people, along with the complete ruthlessness of the Swiss banks for stealing gold, Nazi gold, essentially, which has been stolen from Jewish people, refusing to offer anything to the Jewish people on legal grounds. And of course, just the fact that it's 9/11 as well. So that's almost like the cherry on top of an interesting conspiracy theory and a great follow-up from your World War II one. So for that reason, this gets another 9 out of 10 from me. I really, really liked it.
Don't forget as well the Swiss educated Kim Jong-un.
There we go. I think, yeah, so it's not the first, not the second time. It's the third time now we've been talking about the Swiss. They've been building up a reputation in the co-conspirators' annals. And I'm assuming that we are reverting back to the normal believability
We
metric.
are, yep.
Certainly, it's far-fetched. There's certainly some elements that either very well-placed coincidences, but it does get one thinking that you never know until it's absolutely categorically proven that the Swiss and Bin Laden were not communicating, even though that might not even be relevant because it might have been the US government. I'm not ruling anything out. You don't want to remain open-minded entirely. But when you do consider it's almost too convenient for the fact that so many documents were destroyed in the World Trade Centers. Also, one of the supposed targets might have been this bank in California, which also contained lots of documents with regards to the Swiss's not illegal but immoral refusal to give up stolen Nazi gold, which was originally belongs to Jewish families of basically who have had members of their families die in the Holocaust. So that leaves an uneasy feeling in the stomach. And you wouldn't want to think that anyone could be not petty and vindictive, but just be or heartless, but just to go that length to kill thousands of people just to maintain your gold and ensure you have further economic booms in the future because you've got so many reserves. But just for the sheer interest here, right, how interesting I found it, it's going to get, I'm going to give it a 4 out of 10 on believability, which might be artificially high.
Wow.
There's something in it, I think.
I'll give my thoughts too. In terms of the overall score as a conspiracy theory, it's getting extra points from me just for coming completely out of left field. I don't think anybody is aware of this theory. And kind of like Callum said, when you first mentioned that that was the topic, I thought, oh, it's going to be very little on this. And then there just seems to be more and more details on it. So yeah, I think overall theory, I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10. For the believability, I think, as you say, Switzerland are a very secretive country. They own, what was it, 30 times more gold per capita. Don't know if Mr. T's moved there or something like that. But yeah, it seems to be a lot on it. I think probably a lot of it's coincidental, the whole 9/11 stuff in Mein Kampf, and then making the link to Switzerland via that and what was already discussed in a previous podcast. But yeah, it's a really entertaining theory, I think. In terms of believability, I might not be quite as kind as Callum, because I think it's just such a huge risk. You'd have the whole world turn against you if this ever came out, and all that gold would inevitably be seized, and they'd probably be declared war on. So it's a bit of a risk to protect themselves from a few lawsuits.
Would they remain neutral in the war that's declared on there?
I
up to them. They're getting slaughtered either way.
They declare themselves neutral, but they still participate in the fight by basically hiring foreign mercenaries or something to fight for them.
So yeah, I think all things considered, I think even this seems a bit high, but I'm going to go for a 2.5 out of 10 for believability, I'm afraid.
Yeah, thanks for that, John. I will say it's always interesting to like kind of dig deep into a conspiracy theory that's not really out there, and sometimes even find some stuff out yourself and kind of add it to the theory. Like, it all just lines up. It's like the stars aligned for me on this one. It was very interesting, and to kind of refer back to an old conspiracy as well is always nice. So yeah, I'm gonna give it a 7.5 for a conspiracy. In terms of believability, it has got some stuff to it. The evidence is a bit lackluster. You guys scored it highly, but it remains to be seen whether, you know, the plans from Osama bin Laden actually were on this California bank, and whether there was actually documentation. It's kind of just me taking the word of a conspiracist rather than like an official source. But the lawsuit did come out of the World Trade Center, but whether or not, you know, it's linked is a different story. Just to prove that I don't have any beef with Switzerland, I'm going to score this a 2 out of 10 on believability.
Very diplomatic there.
And that wraps up the ratings there. So, John, have you got a conspiracy for us?
Yeah, I'll see what I can do. So,
I'd like to hear.
Yeah. So my theory looks at a controversial and outlandish take on the 9/11 attack. It's a theory that's gained some traction in the last few years. That is the theory that there were actually no planes used during 9/11. Deafening silence. I can hear you all shocked by that one.
Was it an electromagnetic weapon? Is that what was used?
To be honest, this theory doesn't... It goes into a little bit about what could have been used instead, but it's more about just...
Why there weren't.
Some of the reasons why people think there weren't any planes.
Yeah.
So yeah, former chief economist under the Bush administration, Morgan Reynolds, argues that no planes were used during the attacks. Reynolds claims it's physically impossible that the Boeing planes of flights 11 and 175 could have penetrated the steel frames of the towers, and that digital compositing was used to depict the plane crashes in both news reports and in subsequent so-called amateur video. Quoted, there were no planes and there were no hijackers. He says, I know, I'm out of the mainstream, but that's just the way it is. The only explanation, according to David Shaler, is that they were actually missiles surrounded by holograms made to look like planes. Watch footage frame by frame and you will see a cigar-shaped missile hitting the World Trade Center. Most no-plane theorists, including Thierry Mason and Reynolds, assert that either CGI of a passenger plane was overlaid onto a winged cruise missile or a military aircraft, or that CGI of a passenger plane were inserted into the video footage and the plane-shaped explosive cutouts were planted in the buildings in order to create the impression of plane impact.
Was Kubrick directing it by any chance?
I can't confirm or deny, I'm afraid.
You know, for his revolutionary camera techniques, who knows if he was taking the next step onto CGI.
You never know. I mean, it's not too big a leap to make, you wouldn't have thought.
Less of a leap than having complex hologram technology in 2001.
Yeah, I know, but it's the whole myth of, well, the whole theory behind like black technology and things we don't know about that actually exist.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Within governments, which again, I think that's almost a certainty, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I think I did remark when I looked, well, watched some of the footage I mentioned in my theory that the second plane hitting the tower looked very suspicious to me.
Yeah, well, maybe it gives a bit of weight to this theory then. A lot of people say, you know, that it's supposedly clearly CGI. I don't know about clearly, but there's certainly a few things that don't look quite right. So this theory is actually so controversial that the discussion of no-plane theories has been banned from certain conspiracy theory websites, and advocates of the theory have been threatened with violence by posters at some of these websites.
You'd think conspiracists would like to band together and not to shun any of their fellow people challenging the narrative.
I think you say that, but some really stupid, like, out there theories with no evidence can really, like, bring down the whole community. I think this is,
yeah,
I think
exactly.
This is like, one of the main communities that gets brought down by, like, idiots, I guess.
Not people making conspiracy theories about Switzerland being the actual
The Boeing planes used were made of aluminium, a strong but light metal. As strong as it is, there's a reason why planes don't reach their top speed until they reach altitudes of tens of thousands of feet. This is obviously because of things like air resistance, and the air's a lot thinner up there, so you can travel a lot faster. Travelling at over 500 miles an hour, the Boeing jets would surely have shaken themselves apart due to the huge levels of air resistance acting upon the plane, meaning the plane would have shed parts flying over New York, which obviously didn't happen. The planes didn't shake or even slow down at all on approach, again pointing some to the conclusion that the planes were actually not planes at all. The damage to the Twin Towers and the entry point of particularly the second plane also led many to draw the same conclusion. The plane has been described as a butter plane for the way that it melts through the building, with the nose even seeming to appear outside the back of the building. Surely the plane would have shattered into pieces upon impact, rather than appear to morph through the building, leaving an almost cartoon-like hole. This is far more indicative of a missile than a plane crash. On the topic of damages, the entry hole at the Pentagon was mere metres wide, rather than the 48-metre wingspan that the Boeing 767 had. This suggested that the plane did an acrobatic turn and hit the building following a 45-degree spin, as briefly touched on by Callum earlier in his theory, which obviously seems pretty unlikely that you would go to the effort of doing that while also causing less damage.
Unless you want to preserve lives within the Pentagon.
Precisely.
You know the whole 5-metre hole thing?
Yeah.
Could it just be that, you know, the wings aren't as strong as the core, so the hole's made by the core and then the wings kind of just get destroyed?
I mean, I suppose possibly, but you would think it would have to, for it to only be that wide, I think the nose is sort of exactly the width of the hole, and it would have to go in perfectly straight and not cause any structural damage around it. And the wings would, in essence, have to snap off. Whereas at the Pentagon, there was basically no debris at all. There certainly weren't full wings kind of left behind.
And plus, surely as designers of planes, given that wings are pretty integral parts to the overall plane, and you rely on those to actually get airborne, you want to make them pretty solid and be able to withstand any forces on them that might cause them to fall off mid-flight.
They do shake sometimes, don't they, though, when you're on a plane? It's a bit off-putting.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, the Pentagon cameras have never released footage of the crash, but a leak appeared to show a small white flash appear on the cameras before impact. This flash certainly did not look like an 116-ton plane, again making many speculate that it was actually a missile flying through the air that hit the building.
Yeah, I've definitely heard the missile hitting the Pentagon theory before.
Yeah, and I think it, like you say, it's mainly born out of, I don't think there were really reports of people seeing a plane flying low in that area, and then the complete lack of debris like of a plane, and then the entry hole. I think it all seems to point people who are theorising about it towards a missile rather than an actual plane.
And also, I think that immediately in the aftermath of the plane in question hitting the Pentagon, there was people videoing that the aftermath of the footage, but then the FBI immediately swooped in on the surrounding buildings and seized all video records.
Yeah, that is very suspicious.
Yeah, it doesn't really add to the credibility of the plane hitting it. Surely, maybe just for brevity, just want to show, okay, why it was a plane, especially these conspiracy theories now coming out.
Yeah, exactly. Or even if you did seize it, you would then release it once the theories came out.
Yeah.
Yeah, again, on the kind of topic of footage, a news helicopter on the day of the event released footage that appears to show a shiny ball hit the towers and not a plane. The ball takes a very steep trajectory before hitting the building and then causing an explosion. The shape certainly doesn't look like a plane, as shown by the other pieces of footage.
Sergio Ramos penalty finally landed.
The shape certainly doesn't look like a plane, as shown by the other pieces of footage, prompting many to question which video of the event, if any, can be trusted.
So if it's just a ball-shaped object, don't be ruling out those Ebens from our previous podcast, even extraterrestrial visitors going wayward in New York instead of a New Mexico desert time.
Can't catch a break. They're crashing into each other and they're crashing into World Trade
Empire State.
So yeah, this added weight to a theory shared by many that perhaps the planes were in fact drones or disguised missiles. Or as Callum says, you never know, alien spacecraft. A claim that initially seems preposterous, but is suddenly given chilling credibility given the declassified Operation Northwood plans from the US government, which we've touched on before in the Beirut / kind of times where the government have provably lied episode. So check that out if you want to hear more on that. But kind of briefly, sensationally, this document explains plans to disguise drones and missiles as commercial planes to fly into buildings on US soil and then blame terrorist organizations or enemy nations in order to turn public opinion the way the US desired. The TV footage of the second plane hitting a tower also contained a half-second cut to black immediately before impact. Now, TV cameras normally run a few seconds behind so that they can edit things such as swearing or even more sinister and serious things such as this. However, the timing of the fade to black wasn't in a place to obscure the impact of the plane. It was just before. The footage of the plane hitting the building was still visible, which suggests the screen didn't go black to stop people seeing the impact, but for another reason. Some speculate that it was actually because the angle at the time showed the plane more clearly looking like a missile or a drone, so the footage was quickly cut and edited before the actual impact.
Surely if you wanted to do a cover-up in that manner, because given how fast the plane's flying, surely you could just, I don't know, cut out a few frames that show the plane, and then you still have it razzing it into the building.
Do you say the news footage is a couple of seconds behind?
Yeah, that's normally standard. It's a few seconds behind so that if anything happens, they have time to bleep it very quickly.
apart from when Harvey Price is on Good Morning Britain.
Yeah. No, there was still a few seconds behind, but they thought, fuck it, we'll leave it. Okay, so another aspect of 9/11 that is kind of very popular in the world of conspiracy theories, but is still not very well known about outside of it, is World Trade Center 7, which was the third tower that went down on that day. Now, World Trade Center 7 wasn't even hit by a plane, but it went down in much the same way as the North and South Towers on 9/11. If the same impact and effect was possible without a plane, then surely the same could be said for the towers that were hit. Hundreds of eyewitnesses said that they didn't see a plane, but heard what sounded like explosions coming from the basement and further up the building. These claims are often looked at as proof that the planes weren't the sole reason for the collapse, and that actually there was some sort of controlled demolition. However, the overlooked part of these claims, because it seems so outrageous, is that there were actually no planes, and a huge number of people are reported seeing no planes. So yeah, that kind of ties this one up. I appreciate it probably won't get the highest on believability just because it is so outlandish. But I'm hoping it was at least interesting, and you never know, might change a few minds. So over to you guys for the ratings.
Don't do yourself a disservice there. It's definitely an interesting theory, and it does. I kind of want to give it a higher believability just because it does sort of corroborate my angle that the terrorists weren't actually in the planes. But it extends it a little bit further, say there were no planes whatsoever on these flight paths, and everything else that I identified can be explained by the fact that it was missiles and not actually commercial airliners.
And I think, as part of it, is it wasn't ruling out the possibility that it was missiles made to look like planes.
Yeah.
So it isn't really going as far as saying nothing hit them and they just blew up. So I think it adds believability in that sense as well.
Yeah, when you're comparing between either a CGI for some of the footage or a missile that's actually displaying a hologram around it as it's flying through the air, people are seeing what they think is a plane, or maybe just it's more of like a cutout of a plane. I'm not sure how that would work around a missile, but it's going to blow up either way if you crash into a building, especially because missiles are not designed to do. So I'm probably erring more towards that than the hologram angle, if you're going to try and eke the believability up as much as possible.
Yeah.
But it's hard, though, given that you said yourself that this conspiracy isn't viewed particularly favourably by other conspiracy theorists and on certain forums. If it's these people mentioning this to get shunned, it doesn't bode well because it could potentially discredit the wider narrative.
In fairness, though, I don't know how much detail the people who were saying this have gone into. So, like, say there was a forum discussion of 9/11 and someone goes, oh, you do know there are actually no planes on 9/11. I don't know whether the conversation was just cut there and they're like, right, get out. Or whether they were actually like, hear me out.
Just drop that bombshell and just leave off your own accord.
This might drop.
Yeah. Certainly would be confusing the FBI agents reading all the chats. We've got another angle to account for. Actually, no, they're doing it themselves. They're discrediting themselves. I'll leave it to it. But overall, it's definitely a very interesting series. And it is, of course, an angle that's sort of come to light a little bit later, maybe given that we've had hologram technology and stuff sort of hit the more mainstream in recent years. Military technology is probably a decade or so ahead of what we get to the public, perhaps even more if they've got all the alien tech that we've discussed in previous episodes. So how was to say they couldn't effectively live CGI the shell of a plane around a missile? Certainly several anomalies I raised relating to the speed of the approach, which you also further corroborated with the fact that the plane would be rattling all over the place if given the increased air resistance at lower altitudes. Because they were hitting top speeds of about 500 miles per hour in the flight things I analysed. So, And also just the Pentagon impact zone being very precise in both the size of the hole and actually the place where they hit, which I also touched on. So for that reason, I'm going to give it an 8.5 out of 10 as a conspiracy. And it certainly does help mine out quite a bit. But for its believability, I will have to go slightly lower than my one. I did give Luke's I think I gave it a 3 or a 4, if I remember correctly. I'm probably hovering around that area as well, just because it does seem to be, as ridiculous as it sounds, quite a lot of evidence that stacks up around it, if you maybe highlight a few coincidences here and there. But for that reason, I'm going to go for a 3.5 on the old believability.
Not too bad. I'll take it. Thank you very much. Luke, what do you reckon?
It's definitely an interesting one, and I think in a way it kind of ties in quite a lot of theories. Controlled demolition theory, your theory on the electromagnetic weapon, I guess those could also be explained by this if you put a spin on it in a way that happened, and then they doctored the CGI videos to see the planes to cover that up. So it's interesting, and it ties into many other theories, so I'm going to give it a solid 9 out of 10. In terms of believability, it's just a tough one because there are a lot of flaws in, you know, the way things happen with the holes and stuff like that. One thing I was interested in is why would a plane like disintegrate at 500 miles an hour? Like, I know that, you know, the land speed record is around 750 miles an hour, something stupid like that. I mean, I'm guessing a plane could be would be built in a similar fashion to withstand that kind of resistance, just in case, you know, there was any major turbulence if they were up in the sky.
I think on that point you
Thought
just
was
raised
missing.
that because the whole airline industry now is all about efficiency and, in essence, money making, and it was back then. Planes are designed to fly at the perfectly efficient altitude of, you know, tens of thousands of feet. So they're not used to flying at a much lower speed, at a lower altitude, almost like a meteor. When they come in way too fast, like an engine's gone wrong or something, they do start shedding parts and little bits start falling off, and then they kind of catch fire as well in the air, just because there's so much of that air resistance that they just aren't designed for. Whereas I think if a car that was trying to break a record would be designed to withstand all that. So I think that's probably why, or at least why people say that they wouldn't have been able to go at their top speed when not in perfect conditions.
I think as well, for me, things that make me question some of the flaws are, you know, it's such a unprecedented. Do we really know what to expect? Like, what kind of width would the hole be if a plane crashed into a Pentagon at that speed? Like, what should we really be expecting? But without doubt, there are flaws, so there is definitely some believability. So I'm going to score it a 4 out of 10. I think it does well in terms of 9/11 conspiracies goes. You can tie it in with so many of the kind of more
Yeah, it's the
believable.
glue just for 9/11 conspiracies.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when you think of any theory really that kind of involves Bush or anything apart from the hijackers, you can add this to it and say, you know, they doctored the images and actually
Yeah,
did
that is
this.
very true, actually. I'll quickly rate it myself. I think I'm going to give it a 9 out of 10. I think it gets bonus points for being outlandish. Because if you ask someone, what do you think about 9/11, the two things they're going to say is planes and towers. So to say that one of those things wasn't actually there, it's pretty ballsy. So yeah, I think overall, I'm going to give it a 9 as a theory.
I'm a little bit surprised that no eccentric billionaire has decided to run a simulation of the Twin Towers by either flying an actual drone, fully sized airliner into a replica of the Twin Towers, or just a similar massive concrete, just to see what sort of impact it would make.
It's very true. Maybe if this podcast takes off and we get a few anonymous donations, we'll give it a
Anyone in the US government wanting to break rank?
go.
Hit this up.
If our donations reach 1 billion quid, we'll
That's
do
when we set the Patreon at the top donor goal. Lifetime replication of the Twin Towers for conspiracy's sake to prove a point.
it. The thing is, you could do that. We could do it. And then it, for example, shows that the planes hardly make a dent and the towers are still standing. And then you still have people saying, oh, but it wasn't raining on 9/11, things like that. So
Yeah.
it'd just be a waste of money anyway.
It'd be pretty spectacular, though.
It would.
Good luck
We'd
trying to
probably
get.
make the 1 billion quid back in
Can you imagine how
YouTube
under Can you imagine how underwhelming it would be, though, if
views.
it was almost like the actual Sat Alpha
Yeah. Makes
all
the
this
coffee
time?
exact flight path. It goes in like the butt of the plane.
Just you'd break millions of hearts worldwide.
Like we
They'd get
tried,
there
but
on
then the
time.
week ago the argument, oh, it wasn't raining or the air, the humidity
Yeah.
wasn't optimal.
One thing I tell you is the Credit Suisse and the Swiss government will not be donating any money for that domain.
Okay, so for my believability score, I think we've kind of moved more towards, in terms of believability, that if you go above a 5, you're leaning towards it being more true than not true. And then below 5, the opposite. I think if you were to put me on the spot and say, do I think planes were used during 9/11, I would say yes. So for that reason, it's got to be below 5 for me. There's certainly loads of interesting points in there. And, you know, just because it used planes doesn't mean it was planes that we were told they were. And they could quite easily have been military or even drone planes. So yeah, it's a difficult one. It does point out a lot of holes. It does tie theories together, like Luke said, which is, you know, it's always a good thing when they start corroborating each other. But I think believability, I might go for a 3.5. Okay, so that's all our theories done. So now it's time to hand over to Callum for everyone's favorite part of the podcast, and that is a game of conspiracy.
Thank you very much, John. Right, it's that time of the episode where believability gets thrown out of the window. Following what seems to be a recent trend for our conspiracy segments, I've elected to add yet another twist, partly because I think I exhausted my creative reserves devising the conspiracy for our first 9/11 episode, and also because Luke's theory about Switzerland orchestrating attacks was far more interesting than anything I could have hoped to have come up with, so I didn't want to steal his thunder. It's not quite the 8-round conspiracy pub quiz, but it could be seen as another step in the right or wrong direction, depending on whether you're a conspiracy traditionalist or an innovator. So how's it going to work this week? As host, I'm going to be playing the role of Quizmaster. Since this is our second episode investigating 9/11, I'll be asking my two co-hosts a series of multiple choice questions based upon theories detailed enough within our first 9/11 podcast. To avoid any bias that might arise from my co-hosts knowing their own theory better than the other, it's not going to be a head-to-head affair. Instead, I'll be asking Luke questions about John's theory, and John will answer questions about Luke.
Oh no! I was going to say, I barely remember my own.
Well, they are multiple choice.
Should be very.
This is a good idea. Yeah, I'm looking forward to this.
In the event of a draw, we'll have a tiebreaker question about the theory I presented, and that will be head-to-head. So hopefully this will test your ability to retain information, and not just be a case of who's able to guess the best, but we'll see. Right, to decide who gets the decision to go first or second, I'll ask just a general 9/11 trivia question. So are we ready?
Damn right.
I'm ready.
Fingers on those proverbial buzzers.
Are we just shouting it out?
Yeah, if you want. First answer, or first correct answer. It's multiple choice, by the way, so wait for those before you shout out, unless you know the answer. How many tons of wreckage were produced at Ground Zero?
C.
I would hang higher than that one. I will give you the three answers to give John a chance. A, 1.8 million tons. B, 900,000 tons. Or C, 2.7 million tons.
I'm going to stick with C.
John?
I mean, absolutely no idea, but I'll go with A.
Luke's early gamble has not paid off. John is correct. And it was 1.8 million tons. And just a little fun fact, it took 9 months to sift meticulously through all of this wreckage and attempt to find human remains, but they didn't turn up the black boxes, unfortunately. So, John, do you want to go first or second?
First, please.
Bold move. Right, so you'll be answering questions about Luke's theory, which is the idea that insider trading was used to predict 9/11 and various parties were able to profit off a disaster. So are you ready for your first question?
Yeah, I'm ready.
What kind of market was the subject of seemingly suspicious trading patterns in the weeks leading up to 9/11? A, Forex. B, put options. Or C, derivatives?
I'm going to go for put options.
A.
That is a correct answer.
Come on.
Oh, I'm absolutely screwed for this one.
I tried to keep them sort of, well, not guessable, but there's obviously multiple choice. So the next one. And on the 6th of September, just 5 days prior to the attacks, how much had the put option volume for United Airlines stock risen in value following suspected insider trading? A, 2 times higher. B, 20 times higher. Or C, 100 times higher?
God, they're very different, those three answers to each other. I might take a punt on 100.
He shoots, he scores.
Get in.
2 for 2. Right, and the final question of the round is, what was the value of the US Treasury notes purchased by an unknown sovereign wealth fund, rumoured to be Saudi Arabia or China, the day before the 9/11 attack? For context, these soared in value following the economic collapse caused by 9/11. So you've got A, $2 billion, B, $20 billion, or C, $500 million.
$20 billion.
That is wrong. So 2 out of 3, which is not bad, given I was not really sure how these questions would go. So all to play for, Luke, for your round.
Oh, what was the answer to that one? Because I seem to remember the whole point being that not many countries could have afforded it.
It's $2 billion.
No, okay.
The idea is that not many countries actually have a sovereign wealth fund. So, for example, America and the UK don't have one. So the richest sovereign funds aren't like, you know, trillions and trillions in the billions, I think.
But the country was big enough to avoid suspicion from the SEC, so the transaction got passed straight away, which was convenient. It was the day before 9/11.
He's got a chance here, then.
So, Luke, for your questions on John's theory of the collapse of the buildings being either an energy weapon or something just completely unexplained. So, how many floors made up each building for the World Trade Center? A, 100, B, 110, or C, 120?
Oh, man.
I don't know this.
100 just seems too round, too perfect. Like, whenever you hear the Shard or, you know, Burj Al Arif, and probably butchered that, but in Abu Dhabi, no, in Dubai, you always hear, like, something random, like, you know, 67, 94 floors. So I think 100 would not be correct. So it's between other two. I'm just going to go in the middle, I think. I think B, 110.
Very wise move there. It is correct. B, 110 floors. So, according to the theory of controlled demolition, how long should it have taken for the towers to have collapsed completely, not factoring in air resistance? A, 112 seconds. B, 105 seconds. Or C, 97 seconds.
Carl, you're not giving me much spread here. I remember it being around that mark and being a surprise, but God, there's not much spread there at all. I'm going to go for A112 seems to ring a bell.
I'm not sure what bells are ringing because that is the incorrect answer.
97.
That is correct. Well done, John. Well remembered. And that is the theory that each floor would have fallen on top of itself a la pancaking right down to the ground. I don't want to offer bonus points, but does anyone know how fast it actually took place in or how fast the actual towers crumbled?
4 seconds.
Was it, no. Was it even 19 or 9? I can't remember which.
It was roughly 10 seconds. I think the official time was 9.8 from the 9 level.
Yeah, 9.8, that was it.
Which seems to defy all laws of physics. But if you're interested in learning more about that, do check out our first episode. And this third and final question, if you answer this correctly, we go to a tiebreaker. What was the name given to the effect that could have been used to describe a strange phenomenon where a specific frequency of waves can have an incredible effect on metals, which may have been witnessed during the World Trade Center?
Oh, no.
So answer A, Thomson-Newton effect. B, the Taylor-Hertz effect, or C, the Tesla-Hutchinson effect?
That will be A. Now I'm joking, it's C, Tesla-Hutchinson.
Well done. You had me going there with the A.
No, I remember that one.
Just a bit of trivia on the Tesla-Hutchinson effect. It was the idea that a frequency could cause metals to melt, to fuse with different materials, and it was observed on many of the cars in the surrounding areas. So for the tiebreaker, this is relating to my theory of prior knowledge, the military exercises that were going on at the time of the 9/11 attacks, which seems just very suspicious. So according to the Federal Aviation Administration, what is the maximum number of degrees an airline is allowed to deviate from its allotted course with no immediate attempt to recorrect before operators attempt to contact the plane? Is it A, 8 degrees, B, 18 degrees, or C, 45 degrees?
I'll let John go first.
Very noble.
I know what
there's
I want.
No way it's as many as 45. So it's between 8 and 18. So it's before what? Before they have some sort of intervention in terms of communication or in terms of they scramble a jet?
The first stage of intervention would just be communication, yeah, and then the second one, if there's no response, is jet. So it's just basically air traffic control to contact the plane and say what's going on.
18.
Luke, you're going to stick or twist?
He's nicked my answer. I can't go the same as him, can I? So it's a tiebreaker. So I'm going to have to go for 8 because it's definitely not 45.
I am literally 50-50 between A and B. There was no confidence in my answer, so this might have paid off for you.
I was 99-1 on 18.
Oh,
I'll give you the benefit of doubt and I'll go to 8.
Well, Luke's 1% confidence in his answer. He should have trusted his gut. Well, he shouldn't have trusted his gut instinct because A is a correct answer. It's quite difficult to measure the sort of overall difficulty of the questions, but both gave it a good shot and shows something might have embedded in there from that podcast all those weeks ago.
Always learning.
Exactly. Although I think in hindsight, it probably would have been better just to do a closer to the mark guess, but you live and you learn.
Yeah, I have no idea what I've gone for. There weren't any options, to be honest.
No, me either.
Well, I think that does wrap up this game of conspiracy and the podcast itself. So another three very interesting theories surrounding 9/11. It seems to be the gift that keeps on giving, especially when Luke's creative mind is on the works and his vendetta against Switzerland, which we're hoping continues in future episodes because his Swiss don't seem to be the neutral force that they'd like us to believe.
Yeah, who knows what I can come up with next.
Maybe just do a whole episode on Switzerland conspiracy theories. Yes, we'll wrap it up there. Stay tuned for our next episode and keep challenging the status quo.
See ya.
Adios.